Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. This episode we have my friends Lee Diffie and Steve Matchett from the NBCSN Formula One coverage team. Little secret here. It was supposed to be Steve, Lee, and my man David Hobbs. They called in from a drive to one of their awesome, somewhat new venues where they have a little kind of town hall meeting with Formula One fans. Just had one on the East Coast this week with Mario Andretti as their guest. Called in while they were driving there to catch up after last weekend's season opening Australian Grand Prix. Unfortunately, just couldn't really hear David. Couldn't hear him enough to warrant including the audio in this little podcast here. I know I try to be as much of a stickler for audio quality as possible, and getting the three of them to call in on their drive posed a little bit of a challenge. I think we got Lee okay, and we got Steve Matchett okay. Mr. Hobbs, though, unfortunately had to trim his contributions just for the sake of audio clarity, but nonetheless chopped up a lot of things, whether they were surprised at Ferrari and how Ferrari managed to come away with a win with Sebastian Vettel, whether it was Ferrari stepping forward or Mercedes stepping back. A couple other things, had a few laughs in here as we try to, but great insights from Steve and Lee, and also tried to fill in a little bit of commentary myself to go with some of the topics that we covered. So about 20 minutes. Can't guarantee we're going to do this after every Formula One round, but I'm going to do my best to get these chaps, or Will Buxton, or my friend Bob Varsha, or some of the other folks who really love the sport, cover it, or have covered it, just to get into it a little bit more. I've loved Formula One since I was 7 or 8 years old, so that would have been the late 70s, and have followed it ever since, granted, in the terms of the series that I worked in as a mechanic or engineer, team manager, all open wheel stuff here in North America, leading up to IndyCar, a little bit of sports cars. So I've never worked in Formula One, but have followed it incessantly and definitely consider myself to be an F1 geek. So off we go. Gents, tell me about takeaways from Australia. I think one of the surprises for some would be the pace of Ferrari, but I'm also a little bit curious about your thoughts on whether we saw the rise of Ferrari or whether we saw our friends at Mercedes take a step back, either through strategy calls or their overall approach and process to how they got to know their tires, especially the ultra softs leading up to the race, and then found that they might not have learned as much as they should have.
Let's start with a positive. It's always good to, go down that road first. It's a very good thing when Ferrari wins in Formula One. It's just good for the sport. It has a feel-good factor, for the simple fact that they didn't even start on the front row once last year out of 21 Grand Prix. And Vettel checked that box on Saturday and then went on to win. Whether you're a Ferrari fan or not, there's just a feel-good factor to it. And to do that, because I'm sure you're the same, and to Steve, David, myself, for our whole team, the biggest question or the most common question that we always get asked is, who's going to beat Mercedes? And so just for that simple fact, it was a huge positive. And I'm not being anti-Mercedes, I'm just saying it was a huge positive that Ferrari won.
Steve, curious on your thoughts. When I watch Vettel's steering inputs, he is very, very sharp on the steering wheel. I mean, he loads his front tires quickly and in a very hard ramping manner. Obviously, the rear has to follow and the rear has to grip as well. If I'm just looking at a driving style that would tax one's tires, young Mr. Vettel seems to be someone whose style would lean towards a higher rate of wear, yet he was the one who was able to drive hard, get maximum grip from his tires throughout the race, and Lewis, who I did not see attacking his tires as hard, seemed to be caught out almost from the beginning. Was that a surprise to you?
It was a surprise. Not so much Sebastian Vettel's driving style on the tires, but merely the fact that particularly Hamilton, really from lap one, felt unhappy on those tires. I haven't had a chance to see a full replay of the race yet, because I'd like to just sit back and watch it again and take notes of what we saw. But, typically you see Hamilton being very good on tyres and tyre wear, Mercedes being very good on tyres and tyre wear, but not this race weekend. But, of course, we have to remember it's the first race, right? So that'll change. But I would suggest that, Ferrari just seemed a lot more comfortable on their tyres than Lewis did. I mean, it's very rare that you could get that sort of sense of heightened tension from those radio messages from Lewis. If you certainly they got that immediately in this race. And conversely, anything that was coming from Ferrari seemed very calm and stayed and steady. But all in all, I would say, although we've got much more, we've increased the tyre contact patch, because you have to remember that the tyres are new construction, new compound, they're bigger and they're heavier, and we have more downforce on the car. It is certainly true that the cars are moving around significantly more, I would say. They're very much more on the edge than last year's car, where last year's cars, everybody seemed to be on rails, and you could see very limited steering input from certainly the big, you know, the front-running teams. And most of the constructors this year would say that their drivers were having to put a lot more steering effort into the car to control the rear. The cars look very, not unstable, but they look very sensitive to yaw change at the rear. And we saw that from Ferrari, from Mercedes, from Red Bull, from Renault over the course of that weekend. That once those cars start to break away, they're gone in a heartbeat. And talking to engineers and mechanics over the course of that weekend, and I was asking, Pirelli had revised their permissible starting pressures, and they dropped the starting pressures by a PSI on the front tyres, or allowed the teams to do that if they so wanted. But they didn't make that allowance for the rear tyres. So my question to the guys I was talking with was, you know, do you think that taking a PSI or a couple of PSI out of the rear tyres would help shore up the rear of the car, thinking that probably, you know, a little bit too much pressure and it was encouraging oversteer on the car? But nobody I spoke to actually, you know, agreed with that. I also said the problem is we haven't got enough downforce on the rear of the car.
Yeah.
And I think what's happening is, as David was saying earlier on, once that car gets into yaw, that lower rear wing, and you know, the new specified height of the rear wing being about, 6 inches lower than last year, I think once that gets out of clean air and gets into yaw, that's what we're seeing. All of a sudden, you know, there's a lot of legalese aerodynamic expressions like complicated flow structures around the rear of the car, whatever the hell that's supposed to mean. I think it just means the wing isn't getting enough air in old speed. But I think yeah, that's some area they're going to have to look at. And that is certainly an advantage of using the sharp fin on the car to try and just, you know, maintain the quality of the air as it hits that lower rear wing. But it's an area that they're clearly all struggling with.
Yeah, I mean, there's some fairly obvious outcomes that we saw, and I think we all expected. We hoped magic would maybe intervene and resolve them, but it didn't. In the front grip is usually the biggest issue with most race cars. Although we went to wider rear tires, we also went to wider fronts, which was huge. We still have the massive array of front wings, so essentially you've retained the big front aero profile. You've added more grip up front, and although we did go to wider rears, as you noted, we've tucked that rear wing out of the airstream even more. Lo and behold, we have passing that is very hard to pull off because we have lots of turbulence, big wakes coming off the back of the cars, and, you know, not to take a dig at Formula One, but our friends at the Verizon IndyCar Series realized about a year ago that, hey, we need to think about this. We need to peel more of our topside downforce off and really, really empower the floor to take a bigger percentage of our downforce production. We'll have that next year in 2018 when they go to the Universal kit, but I wonder how long it will be before Formula One, as the technical working group comes together and says, okay, good first step, bigger tires, you know, faster, everything's, you know, killing lap times, but the racing part, maybe we need to look at next year to invert where we are making our downforce so that passing also becomes something that isn't just reserved for pit stops.
I heard Sean Todd's slightly surreal comments today about the overall performance of the new cars. He said something like, well, the lack of overtaking is a price worth paying for the new cars. Not for us when we're in the entertainment business.
I love Jean Todt. He's someone whose opinion I have never asked for and rarely seek to hear, but it's kind of him to offer it.
Right.
Lee, one of the things that I had a little chuckle at, and you and I think share a bit of the same sarcastic view, our friend Valtteri Bottas after the race said he was going to improve massively. That seems like a quote we would have expected to hear upon signing his new Mercedes contract, some sort of, all right, great opportunity with the defending champs. I can just knock down the world, and boy, you guys are going to see the best I've ever been. That really isn't something I'd expect to hear after the first race, where did a good job, but I know that had Nico been in that car, the gap to Lewis would have been either non-existent, if not Nico being in front of him. So I don't know about you, but I just thought that was a really bizarre kind of, all right, I'm really going to try harder going into the second round. Seemed very strange placement of that that statement.
I think with Bottas, I think all of us have to keep in mind just how much he has taken on. You know, had 3 years at Williams, came in, you know, had that year after winning the GP3 championship, had that year of just hanging around in the Williams garage, and then he drove for them for 3 years and podiumed and decent qualifying, and, you know, he certainly more than held his own against Felipe Massa. But then when you think about the late nature of the call up to Mercedes, the psychological baggage that goes with, oh my goodness, I've just been hired by the best team in the paddock, and I'm going to be alongside, you know, a triple world champion, and I'm taking over the reigning world champion seat, and. I think for a young guy, that's a lot to take on. And then, you know, he wasn't that thrilled with his qualifying performance. And then, you know, I just think it's a whole new world for him. And I don't know, maybe I'm being too sympathetic, but I think, you know, we've got to give him a little bit of time. But I understand what you're saying about the comment. I think it's fair to give him, you know, maybe even give him half a dozen races to settle in. And the harsh people would say, no, he's a Formula One driver, he's paid millions of dollars a year, he's got to deliver now. Yeah, fair point too. But also, look at what Penske did to Simon Pagenaud. They gave him a whole year to settle in. Next year, he won the championship. So, yeah, I think it's fair to give Bottas a little bit of time.
Fair enough. Curious anyone's thoughts on Checo. I know that when I spoke with your colleague and our friend Will Buxton going into Australia, he said he'd be very curious to see how young Mr. Perez dealt with the extra tires, the extra tire width, I should say, but the extra grip, extra aero. He's someone who had proven himself as the master of conserving a car under the previous regulations with less grip and rising to the top before the end of the race. Wasn't sure if he was going to be able to manhandle these new, beefier F1 cars, but I thought he was rather impressive. Did any of you come away with the same impression?
I think Perez is one of the most underrated drivers on the grid. Now, let's not forget, if you compare him to his previous teammate, Nico Hülkenberg, who's had 116 Grand Prix and hasn't had a podium yet. Hasn't had a podium in over 100 Grand Prix. And he seems to get all of the fanfare and fuss. And there's old Sergio, just workmanly-like, gets about it. What's he had? He's had about 6 or 7 podiums in his career, and he's so underrated. I think, you know, he's a low-fuss guy, so therefore he doesn't create any hype. He's not a self-promoter, but I think he's one of the most underrated drivers on the field.
Well, I don't want to tip David over, and, you know, also charging this question with the president of the Hülkenberg fan club would be unfair. So, Steve, maybe you can help me here. There are a couple drivers that stood out. I always look at each race, whatever category, for the risers that we didn't expect, and also those who somehow entered the witness relocation program. And young Mr. Nico Hülkenberg was atop my list of, was he in the race? Also looked at Jolyon Palmer. I don't know if he was just a lightning rod for problems or if that's just the universe saying, son, it's time to go try Indy cars. And Kevin Magnussen, I know we all hoped he would have a strong debut to show that 2016 was a little bit of a fluke, but obviously he also was the recipient of the universe's cartoon anvil. So anyway, Steve, just curious if you could share some thoughts, at least after round one, for young Mr. Hülkenberg, young Mr. Palmer, and also Mr. Magnussen.
I think Palmer, he just does seem to attract bad luck somehow. I mean, I don't really know him that well, to be honest. I don't really know Hülkenberg that well also. But Palmer, if there's something odd going on within the team, he'll find it. He seems to be able to find problems there. You know, he had that spin, had that problem over the weekend with his car as well. And Magnussen, I think, you know, talking to the guy that Haas, and with Gunther. I mean, they seem very high on the idea that he seems very calm, very controlled, is extremely easygoing. I just think probably that was a bad weekend for Max. I'm prepared to chalk that one up to a bad weekend, and let's get to the next race and see what happens. This Haas generally just had a bit of an odd weekend.
Great qualifying.
Grosjean complaining about the brakes at the start of the race weekend, but then seemed to get on top of it and did a tremendous job in qualifying.
I think that might just be a personality tick, actually. I think just in the middle of dinner, he could be swimming, he could be sunbathing. There's just going to be these little short Tourette-like outbursts about brake problems. I think that's actually just a personality tick that's developed.
Well, we need another race or two races to see whether or not both cars continue to have brake problems, or it's only one car that continues to have brake problems, and that'll be the answer to the Tourette's question.
Any thoughts on whether we might see our boy Hulkenberg emerge from a witness relocation program he entered in Australia?
Yeah, I think it's the same again. I'm prepared to give almost any of these guys the benefit of the doubt. It's the first race with such a radically changed car. I think by the time they get to the second race and the engineers have sat down with the drivers and gone through the terabytes of data that they will have collected from that first race, I think we'll see very different cars, tailored towards their drivers a lot more, and let's see what happens at round two. I mean, I know that's a bit of a cop-out answer, but the first race of a new season is always a bit strange anyway, and combine that with brand new tyres and brand new cars and brand new aerodynamics, and the whole characteristics of the cars are so different that I'd like to see round two, and by the end of round three we'll have more of an idea of who's doing well and who's just simply not doing well.
Last question for you guys. So should we either lobby the FIA to take down any of their radar guns to eliminate trap speed data, or should we just try and accelerate the talks between McLaren and Mercedes? I mean, obviously, the numbers being put up by the Honda over the weekend were not particularly flattering. It's obviously a little bit messy to consider that such a proud, rich team is at least, in the rumor mill for discussing going back to its former engine partner, also while knowing that Honda plays a significant role in their funding. Curious how you guys see this playing out and whether there might be any substance to McLaren seeking other options this early, and if they could even do that if they had to.
You know what? I think we're talking hypothetically. Pardon me. I think if they were to amicably part from Honda and do a deal for Mercedes, I don't think they would have a problem with that on the commercial side of things with Zach Brown there now and a new commercial director of the team as well. I don't think they would have a problem securing commercial partners if they went back to Mercedes. I, in fact, think it would be a positive. People would be, I don't want to say lining up at the door. It's not that easy, as we all know. But I think, given the history of McLaren, given how good the car is, the chassis, which both drivers report, and the aero is terrific, the car drives very well. It's just the power unit that is the core issue, right? I think if they went back to Mercedes, I think that would be just fine.
Anybody here thinking our friend Zach Brown is looking to see if there are some easier and greener pastures in America or somewhere driving vintage race cars instead of this cauldron of deficiency he has inherited?
Well, it certainly wouldn't be an easy transition for them from an engineering standpoint because they'd have to produce some new monocoques to be able to do that. I mean, they certainly have the infrastructure to be able to do that, but McLaren would be helped by the fact that they're all 1.6 litre V6 turbos, and much of the specification of the engines from constructor is specified, so it's not like you're trying to bolt a V8 into a car that was designed for a V12 or vice versa, so at least you've got a reasonable hope of getting the weight distribution somewhere close. But as we've seen with Renault in the past, when they had to make that transition from Mercedes to Renault, it was a pretty dire year for them in terms of getting the car to work. But I just think, like David said, it's just a tragedy, really, that McLaren-Honda partnership clearly isn't working. And, I always think whatever we see from the teams, the little bit we hear about the teams being unhappy with one another, Honda not being happy with McLaren, McLaren not being happy with Honda. It's a bit like an impending divorce. You know, you, in public, you get to see about 10% of it, but of course, behind the scenes, it must be an absolutely catastrophic relationship for us to see that 10%.
It's unfortunately reminding me a little bit of 1983, the little spirit team in Honda, in terms of, and I actually love that approach. Hey, let's come in with a small and unheralded team with no expectations. Let's figure out what we are doing, and once we're confident in that, then we can go and talk to a Williams or otherwise to use our power plant. Obviously, McLaren quite happy to have all the other things that come with the Honda package, but part of me thinks that there are some other teams down the grid that would actually maybe be better suited to deal with the growing pains involved here before one of the bigger teams shows up with great expectations at each round. So, well, gents, thank you. Greatly appreciated.
Good chatting with you, Marshall.
And that was Lee Diffie and Steve Matchett from the NBCSN Formula One coverage team. They're going to be looking after the Chinese Grand Prix, which comes up April 9th, same weekend as the Long Beach Grand Prix. So I'll be in Long Beach. They will be covering China remotely. And again, if we have some time, hopefully we can catch up with some of our friends from NBCSN to look back at how round number two, the 2017 FIA Formula One season, has gone. As always, I'm Marshall Pruitt. Thanks for listening.